The National Organization for Women is one of the oldest and largest women's organizations in the country, probably in the world. But in recent years, the organization has lost some of its prominence with grassroots feminists. Terry O'Neill was elected president of NOW in June, with a mission to reconnect with the grassroots movement. In a closely contested election, Terry and her slate defeated a slate headed by 33-year-old Latifa Lyles. The election results surprised many members, because Latifa Lyles was a vice president of NOW under outgoing President Kim Gandy and was Gandy's choice for a successor. Terry is a former law professor at Tulane University in New Orleans and the University of California at Davis. She began her feminist activism in the 1990s, fighting right-wing extremists in the Deep South. She has served as president of Louisiana NOW and a member of the National Racial Diversity Committee. I sat down with Terry O'Neill in early September. We began by talking about the widespread perception that her election represents a missed opportunity for NOW to expand its constituency and relevance beyond its historical base.
I don't think that that's irrelevant. I think that is a serious consideration. In fact, it's a consideration that I took very seriously in deciding whether to run. I didn't decide to run until 5 weeks out from the election, precisely because I do believe that the organization needs to reach beyond people who look and talk like me. On the other hand, both teams, and we do run in teams, we have a shared leadership model in NOW. There's a president and three vice presidents who run together. Both teams were very strong. My team has two 29-year-olds on it. It was very important to me to have a broad spectrum of life experience. Both teams are very much on the same page in terms of basic philosophy. What is it that drives us to be feminist activists? We're very much on the same page with that. But method became, I think, a point of difference between us. And the other team was very clear that they felt that moving away from grassroots organizing was a smarter move in the current climate, and that moving more towards nurturing personal relationships with elected officials, particularly elected officials in Washington, to get a seat at the table, quote unquote, that was really the way to go and it was the better way to lead the organization. I felt that getting back to the grassroots and actually turning more of our resources to grassroots was the better way to go, and I argued for that. I think we are a member-dependent organization. I think our funding needs to continue to be member-dependent and member-driven. I ran on a platform of NOW being the grassroots arm of the women's movement. It's something that I am deeply committed to. I believe that if the movement does not have a grassroots, it really can't call itself a movement. So my goal over the next 4 years is to very much energize, re-energize the grassroots. NOW has a brilliant structure for grassroots community level organizing. And I believe that it's at the community level that change takes place. It's our job at the national office in Washington to nurture what they do. I intend to work very aggressively to work with the other team. They are strong, valuable, important leaders in NOW and in the women's movement. And I really do look forward to working with them.
And what other initiatives are you and NOW taking to reach out to younger women, women of color, immigrant women, low-income women, women who might have been historically excluded?
Yeah, one of the things that we need to do is to expand on our chapter structure. Currently, the chapters are very much geographically based. 2 years ago, the organization's General Assembly voted to create virtual chapters. These are chapters of people who don't necessarily live in the same geographic location, but want to work together on a particular issue, whatever that issue might be. Maybe it's drug policy, maybe it's women in prisons, and so forth. We are also looking at expanding, developing chapters that really are, and perhaps they're located in a particular geographic location, but the reason for their existence is to address a certain type of policy. So, for example, you might see a chapter growing up that really wants to talk about and deal with women in prisons. I know that there is a chapter in New Jersey that has taken on that issue. There is a group in North Manhattan that is predominantly Spanish-speaking. women who are really doing marvelous things and creating a community-based now chapter up there to deal with issues affecting women of color, especially immigrant women, especially Spanish-speaking immigrant women. So we're looking at being able to do chapter organizing and community-based organizing around issues and even around identities, in addition to being location-based. That's one piece. The other piece that we're going to be doing now has long been an organization that does what I call national action campaigns. These are campaigns of education and awareness and consciousness raising. A classic example is our campaign against Walmart. We named Walmart a merchant of shame back in, I guess, 2002 or 2003. And chapters all around the country would adopt their local Walmart store and picket them. And the national office, we kept feeding them more and more information that we were getting by looking at what was coming out of the lawsuit against Walmart, the largest sex discrimination class action lawsuit in the history of the country, had been filed against Walmart, and they were doing discovery, and we kept getting more and more information from the discovery process, and we're making handbills, and we're doing, you know, bullet points and fact sheets and sending it out to the chapters, and the chapters are picketing and giving this information to Walmart customers. It was wonderful. It was not aimed at a particular piece of legislation. It's not something you can go to Capitol Hill and lobby about. It's a national action campaign. And that's one of the things we do. Now, the innovation that my team has proposed, and we are going to be doing it, is we are going to take, say, representatives, probably the chairs, of our national committees. We have a number of nationwide committees that are formed around particular issues or particular identities. We have a committee on women with disabilities, a combating racism committee, a young feminist task force, a global women's issues committee, a family law committee. So my intention, when we create these national action campaigns, someone from each of these committees will be in on the development and implementation of that campaign. We need the expertise of these grassroots volunteer leaders to help shape the language, to help shape the kinds of issues that we're going to address when we go out on a national campaign, for example, around the ERA. We're working on the ERA, on equal marriage, on health care for all. Single payer health care is something that now has long been committed to. And we're going to have a national action campaign on abortion providers and ending the terrorism against abortion providers. For each one of these campaigns, different communities of women experience these issues in different ways. And we're going to be preparing our materials, our language, our approach that is both respectful of the different ways that different communities of women experience these kinds of oppression and also responds to it, not just respectful, but actually taking specific action. So we're going to be bringing in our national leadership on, instead of just having the national staff create an action campaign, we bring in those voices.
So you brought up health care just last night. Was the president's speech to Congress. How do you respond?
My first response is that when the president said that, you know, federal dollars will not be used to pay for abortion, I'm outraged. Let me say that I think there was a lot good in that speech. But it is wrong for the Republican leadership to use abortion and women's need for basic reproductive health care as their political football to derail health care altogether. And let's face it, that's exactly what they were doing. It is wrong for the Democratic leadership to allow that to happen. And I believe that that's what, unfortunately, what President Obama is doing. He's talking about extending the Hyde Amendment to the new health care reform package. And the Hyde Amendment is the abusive law that was passed in the 1970s that prohibited Medicaid from funding women's abortions. And it frankly makes my blood boil. And I will tell you that I personally had an experience. I was escaping violence, 23 years old, and escaping a violent marriage. And shortly after I was able to get away from this guy, I moved into my parents' apartment, and suddenly I think I'm pregnant. And I had no money. It turns out I wasn't, but I went through a period of about 45 days worried about what was happening and what was I going to do, and there was no question in my mind that one way or another I was going to terminate that pregnancy. At the time, I didn't have the money to pay for an abortion. And for policymakers to say, we're going to stop you from building the future that you need to build for yourself, there's no other word for it. It's despicable. And we need to get that kind of thinking out of the health care plan that we are shaping today.
As you mentioned, now is on record as supporting a single-payer healthcare system. Why do you feel that this is the type of system that would most benefit women?
Single-payer is the most cost-effective means of fixing the broken healthcare system, and women bear the brunt of the broken healthcare system. The main problem is that in this country, your access to healthcare, to health insurance, is employer-based. It's employment-based. Women disproportionately work in part-time jobs. They don't that and part-time jobs don't offer health care benefits. Why are we in part-time jobs? Because we have child care responsibilities and the lion's share of elder care responsibilities in caring for sick family members. Women also are disproportionately in minimum wage jobs, which don't have health benefits, disproportionately in non-union jobs that don't have health benefits. So we have less access to health care. We also have higher health care costs than men, and that is generally because of our reproductive health care costs. The biggest cost driver, of course, is pregnancy, prenatal care, and childbirth. Outrageously, when we do have health care insurance, we get less coverage. There are many insurance companies that consider pregnancy to be a pre-existing condition. In other words, if you're pregnant when you get that job that actually has health care attached to it, boom, the insurance company says, oh, you were already pregnant, it's a pre-existing condition. No health coverage for your prenatal care or for your childbirth. That's extraordinarily expensive. And there's another piece of this that I think is really important, and that is that for the past 20, maybe 15 to 20 years, the health care industry has been shifting actual healthcare tasks from industry to family members of people who have been in the hospital and are coming out. You have people who go in for surgery and are being sent home from the hospital with tubes still in their bodies. And what the hospital will do is train the family member to take care of this person. What does that mean? It's really the women who are doing it. So the whole system is really broken, and women are bearing the brunt of that.
The administration recently opened the way for foreign women who are victims of violence to receive asylum more easily, and that's something that women's groups have obviously been pleased by for the most part, but many immigrant rights groups have also been critical of the administration's immigration policy, and especially stepping up the 287G program, which allows local and federal law enforcement officials to cooperate more closely on immigration checks of people taken into custody. So how would you rate the administration's policy on issues that are especially affecting immigrant women?
President Obama came in at a time when there was an awful lot to do, awful lot to make up for those 8 years of the Bush administration. And I know that the Obama administration takes immigration very seriously, but it worries me that we have not moved on immigration reform. Every day that we don't have comprehensive immigration reform, we have more people being rounded up in raids. It's happening in Arizona. I just had an activist in Arizona send me a long email. Thousands and thousands of women and their kids are being rounded up. Very often, a woman escaping violence wants the violence to stop. That doesn't necessarily mean that she wants her abuser to be deported or to go to prison. Very often, the fact of the matter is that the abuser earns more money than she does, and they need that money to pay the rent, and very often they have kids. I worry how we're going to encourage women to come into a safe space and seek asylum if they believe that by coming in to seek asylum, they could trigger an immigration investigation into their abuser. But not just that, many immigrant women are already concerned about coming in to seek safety from violence in their homes simply because of a concern that other people in their household might be investigated. If they go to the authorities, you know, somehow the authorities will have then access to other people in their household or in the community, and that that could put their friends and their family members at risk.
In 2006, Now gave then Senator Obama a rating of 91% out of 100. After the first 8 months or so of the new administration, how would you rate the administration's performance in terms of issues that are important to women?
I would rate it high. There's no question that we have a friend in the White House. But I have said for months, and I still maintain it, friends tell friends when they've made mistakes. And so we are not shy about telling the president or telling the leaders in Congress when we think that they have made a mistake. But that doesn't mean that we don't understand that they clearly are our friends. For example, I'm very happy that President Obama created a White House Council on Women and Girls. I'm very sorry that he didn't create a cabinet-level post. It would have been much better. We need someone who answers directly to the president. I just think that a cabinet-level post would have allowed us to look at outcomes as opposed to inputs, right? So inputs is, for example, a law that says, well, you can't discriminate on the basis of sex. And that's a good input, and it's fine. If the outcome is that we are still at 78% on the wage gap, then we have failed. I love the fact that President Obama, and this is an important symbol that he chose, the first law that he signed as President of the United States was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which overturned the Supreme Court's deeply wrongheaded ruling that if you complained about pay discrimination, you were really put in a no-win situation. You had to complain about the pay discrimination as soon as you learned of it, which means probably so early that you couldn't quite be able to prove intentional sex discrimination in the pay disparity. But if you wait too long to where you could build up a level of proof that, in fact, this is not just me, this is systematic, by that time the Supreme Court says, up too late. So it's a very pro-corporate decision by the Supreme Court. It was wrongheaded, and I'm glad that Congress overturned it in the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. The companion law is the Paycheck Fairness Act, which attempts to grapple with a lot of the many reasons for this persistent wage gap that women suffer. And let's be very clear, African American women are at 64 cents on the dollar that is paid to a white male. Latinas in this country are at 58 cents to the dollar. That's not acceptable. That is not, on average, women are at 78 cents. And that's not acceptable. So the Paycheck Fairness Act has a number of measures that would help us close the wage gap. And I would love to see strong leadership from the White House and from the leaders in the Senate. The House has passed it. Now, I'd like to see the leadership of the Senate, and I'd like to see the White House exert strong leadership to get it passed in the Senate and to get it passed by, to get it signed by President Obama.
One of the issues that we haven't heard very much about in this economic downturn and all the discussion about what's to be done to improve the economy is welfare. And this is, of course, a really critical issue for women. How are things going in terms of welfare and the maintenance and expansion of benefits?
That needs enormous changes. And in fact, the welfare law is up for reauthorization in 2010, and we will be very much engaged in that effort. Currently, the welfare law imposes a 5-year lifetime cap on a person's ability to get assistance under the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. We fought that cap when it was first imposed back in the 90s. Today, we insist that that cap must be lifted at least as long as this depression/recession lasts. How can you say to a woman, your 5 years is used up, there are no jobs out there, we're at near double-digit unemployment in some parts of the country, we are well into double-digit unemployment. You're off assistance. We know there's no jobs. Go get a job. How can you say that to somebody? We also need to count education and training as work. How do you say to a woman, you got through your second year of high school, you're ready to go back, maybe you made some mistakes in your life, you got off track, now, you know, we're going to give you some assistance, and we'll let you go to high school for, like, what, a couple of 3 weeks? And we need very much to recognize the linkage between violence and poverty. Some people think that, you know, if you're living in poverty, you're more susceptible to violence. It's actually kind of the other way around. The reality is that up to 30% of women entering assistance of some form, going into the welfare system, are escaping violence in their own homes. That's why they need assistance.
What one or two things would you like to see women really take action on in the next 6 months or so?
I want women to take action on keeping our abortion providers safe. I think that violence is rising precipitously against them. That's number one. Number two, I want women around the country to become rededicated to passing the ERA. You know, I say that, especially when I say that to people, for example, in California, where the ERA is a no-brainer and was ratified a long time ago, and where there is a state-level ERA, and people say, "You're kidding me." And I say, "No, I'm not kidding." It was a bad thing that we did not pass the ERA. Ronald Reagan teamed up with the corporate insurance companies and other right-wing entities to defeat the ERA. And if we had women's equality in the Constitution, we would have a constitutional base for protecting abortion rights, for advancing lesbian rights and LGBT rights more generally. We would have, in my mind, and I would fight for this, we would have a constitutional base for insisting that government do something to end, for example, health disparities among women. I think it was the Kaiser Family Foundation put out a study a few months ago that documented the extraordinary gap on racial lines among women in health outcomes. What you find is race being a determinative factor in the outcomes for women of color who have diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and white women who have those same illnesses. It's outrageous. That's not equality. That's not equality. In my opinion, an equal rights amendment in the 21st century that promises equality for women promises equality for all women. We need that in the Constitution. It doesn't automatically eliminate health disparities among women, but it gives us a constitutional base to argue that government must now do something to really create equality for all women.
And I assume people can get information about these action agenda items on your website?
Very definitely. Go to our website, www.now.org, and also please go to our blog, www.now.org/blog. It's fun, it's new, it's called Say It, Sister, and we invite comments from everyone.